Hello and welcome to the GAK.co.uk Guitar Shop Podcast. I am your host, Mark Packham, who is with me this evening.
Hello, my name's Matt and I am the manager in store.
I'm Joe and I'm here for all your bass related queries.
You're both very loud. Both very vocal this evening.
Wonderful. I thought that was a normal volume to deliver anything. Are you sure you haven't got your headphones turned up really loud?
No, I haven't got that. I'm looking at the meters. You're both quite loud. We're recording much later than normal and I think it's going to throw an element of chaos into this podcast because none of us have had dinner and...
I think I might have to go back to London.
Matt might have to run back to the station. We've got some Pringles. I wouldn't count that as dinner, though.
No. Pringles.
Pringles. Yeah, it's World Cup.
Because it's World Cup, isn't it?
How are you both?
Very well, thank you very much.
What have you been up to this week?
Playing some guitar. Playing some stereo guitar.
What?
Years.
Playing guitar through your stereo?
No. Playing through two amps and enjoying the Big Sky in true, amazing stereo. It's... Like reverb, but you just haven't experienced reverb until you've heard it in true stereo.
Is this the first time for a while you've plugged the stereo ring in?
Well, it's because I've now got this orange PPC 112 and I've kind of had two valve heads like plugged in through two cabs and it just sounds mental. And it's just so good.
Are there certain patches on the Big Sky that are like more stereo than others?
Yeah, I've got a really good hall setting that's like on an expression pedal. So it starts off like a normal reverb. When you put the expression pedal forward, it goes to like a decay time of like 20 seconds with like loads of modulation and you just hit like one harmonic and it just... It's like floating away on a cloud.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah,
what,
it's great.
What ABY box do you use?
I've got this custom one on the way, which will be here. So basically, at the moment, I'm running it in true stereo at the moment. But this AB will allow me to do that and AB at the same time, which you can't normally do.
Wow.
So it allowed me to run in stereo via A and B rather than just stereo out from a pedal or some both outputs into A or B.
I see. So you can
You don't.
I do.
Don't pretend.
I understand. So you can go out of the Big Sky into two separate amps, box will allow you to go two outs from the Big Sky into one amp?
Yeah, so say for example, if you've got two amps and you've got an ABY box, like a electro-harmonic switchblade.
Switchblade Plus,
yeah. You're only going to be able to go out of one output because they'll only have one mono input.
Yeah.
So no matter what effects you're running, you've always got to go mono into the switchblade to switch A and B to two amps.
Where's the AB in your chain now then?
At the end.
Okay.
But so what it... Well, technically at the beginning? At the end. So basically, guitar goes into the AB box and then goes stereo out into two amps,
okay,
like a normal AB box. But the AB box is going to have an effects loop in it, which runs all my effects, my entire pedal board in one huge loop with a master's on-off switch. But that feeds out mono back in stereo. So
it allows...
So if I hit A plus B, it'll run both amps in stereo. If I hit A or B, it'll run the stereo signal to a mono signal.
And only go into one of...
And only go
to either of the amps.
Yeah, rather than splitting A or B, because then if you had a ping pong delay, you'd get a really staggered delay sound.
Yeah.
Or you wouldn't get the true expansion of both effects.
God, I am so into this sound.
Yeah, so it means that basically, if I took my pedal board somewhere and I couldn't run two amps, I can run into one amp and I'll still get the same effect for all the stereo patches.
Genius.
Yep.
So you don't have to have a... You know, that was the thing about the DV multi-amp, you could have stereo effects, or you could have the stereo bank, and then you could have a mono bank, and then something for live recording. So rather than have to double all my patches... And I've been messing around with loopers as well, so...
Oh, yeah? Loopers. Which ones?
Infinity Looper.
By Pigtronix?
Yes. Which I was talking to Joe about, which I think we'll talk about in depth next week.
Oh, I'm really excited.
We'll talk about next week at the end of this podcast, because very special is going to be happening. How about you, Joe? Been doing any sonic experiments this week?
Well, a few. This week, the guitarist in my band bought a High Gain 100 in addition to his Orange Rocker 30. And then he's got two 412s, which was kind of a bit of an upsize in rig for him. So everything's got louder.
Can you realistically gig that? I'm talking like in today's modern day band advantage. Do you really realistically gig two heads, two 412s?
Yeah, what's wrong with that?
I don't know. It's just been...
Well, we've got a 212 as well, so we could do it with a 212 and a 412 if we need to.
Hmm. Could you do it with just a 212?
No. Why would you want to do that?
Well,
he plays with a 212.
Well, you know, punk bands that no one goes to see and they have to play in really small... I mean, I don't know any of those.
How's he running it in stereo? Is he running a custom AVY box? I don't
know.
No,
it's just a, I think it's just a Switchblade Plus he's got, and then just both separate. So it's just punching in the high watt for all the really, really big, loud, heavy bits.
Yeah, that's. Which, I think that's a good way to do it.
And it is perfectly giggable. I mean, we've got a band van, so it's not like transport's an issue. Mm. And then getting it in and out of venues, I think you just sort of swallow and accept that you've got to move something that's a little bit heavier. I've never thought that that's a big deal, whilst it seems to have become a big deal for the rest of the world.
Mm, that's true.
Big stuff isn't that much of a problem. But anyway, because he's kind of upsized his rig so substantially, I've been kind of thinking, oh, I need to upsize mine as well, which has led me to this sort of crossroads of being like, shall I go stereo? I mean, does a bass really need to go stereo? I mean, Billy Sheehan does it.
Definitely not.
But then, you know, I'm a bit concerned about going to Billy Sheehan. You know, I've already got his signature bass.
That bass that you've got doesn't have stereo out,
but
does it?
No, but you don't. You know, I'd want to do it with an ABY box anyway, so that I could punch in and out of the second amp. I quite like the idea because I appreciate it in the same way that Sheehan sort of sets up his rig. He has one for low end and one for all his mids and treble, and that kind of makes sense on the way a bass works, to sort of split those signals up to make everything a bit clearer. But I don't know, the flip is, it means that two DI boxes have got to go on bass side. I'm trying to think of like how sensible it is as well. And whilst I don't mind being a little bit stupid, it's like I either go stereo or I get a huge rock rig. And I think I'm kind of, you know, as always, you look to sort of big players for sort of inspiration for these things. And there's not enough players that are really doing the Billy Sheehan thing.
I mean, there's a lot of players who like run multiple heads and rigs that all run at the same time.
Yeah, that's pretty standard. I suppose,
and I mean, you've got people like, obviously, like you see now, like Royal Blood, who are using like guitar amps and a bass rig, and they're using like a POG to split it.
Yeah.
But yeah, to see like...
That was one of the questions, to get a guitar rig involved, actually. Yeah. Sorry. Okay.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, is you see guitarists doing that, you don't necessarily have a bassist running like stereo effects into two amps. I think maybe it works better with guitar, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you've got people like Chris Novoselic, who was running a bass rig and a guitar rig.
Yeah.
And he's someone who plays sort of, you know, really kind of big, loud, heavy, aggressive stuff, which is sort of the right sort of end for me. But yeah, the other alternative is I buy a 610 or two 410s. I'm not going to buy an 810 because that is
ungiggable.
That's past the point of me being able to get it into my flat if I don't have someone with me to help.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's not ungiggable. It's unlivable.
I think the thing is you. I think with any rig, and that's partly the reason for this kind of A-B switcher, is that I've made a rig that if I wanted to gig with two amps and I could physically, I can.
Yeah.
But if I can just gig with one, I think that's always the way to think it, is you've got to get your core sound with one and just make it better with two.
Exactly.
But not rely on the second one, because if you make it, that's what I've always found in the past, if you're two amps and you rely on having two amps, it makes it an absolute nightmare.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm not sure. I'm still kind of in two minds. I don't want to go into it too much because my staff pick's going to talk a little bit more about the amps that have kind of caught my eye as being someone that does it quite well.
Intriguing.
But we'll see.
I'll tell you exactly what is going to solve your problem. And it was the setup that I was running a very long time ago, probably 14 years ago. PVTNT. Bass amp, and I'm not sure if the modern ones still do it, but a vintage one will do it. Built-in crossover into a guitar practice amp. I had a PV Rage. So basically, all of my low end and low mid was coming out of the huge 15-inch driver, and all of the top end was then crossed over into a PV practice amp that had distortion on it for all the high end.
So what did you do live then? Did you mic up both?
Yeah, this is Mark Hacken playing in punk bands in sort of the Fitz Herbert about 15 people in
the audience. Yeah, that's why. So you don't, I mean, don't mic it up for a start. It's perfect because the low end is just like chugging away, sounding huge, and then you got this real like defined but distorted high end. It's a wicked setup. Mm.
See, now my problem is with two amps, I'm running one super clean and one like a Voxy clean, like kind of a little bit of push that work really well together. But what if I want a third amp for gain? How am I going to work that in?
Well, something to think on, but I think maybe we should press on. And the reason that is a good in is because we're about to talk about a man who is very much known for using two amps.
Well, even if not more.
Well, yeah, I mean, but, you know, known for using a combination of amps on stage. And this is responding to a listener question we had a few weeks ago who wanted to know how to get the Joe Bonamassa sound.
Did we not do a Bonamassa?
I don't think we did.
Podcast?
I don't think we did. We did a... I just talked over that. It's fine. I think we might have just touched on it a bit, but I think we should probably go into it in detail as we have been asked on it. So, let's talk guitars. What does Joe Bonamassa use?
Loads of vintage gear that no one can afford.
Sweet.
I mean, it's not even his.
To put it simply. But, I mean, yes. I mean, that's the thing. Well, actually, when... So, I mean, some people might not have seen it or, you know, might be new to it. But me and Joe and a couple of the other guys here were lucky enough to meet with him and his tech, which I still can't believe we managed to pull off. That was amazing. That was
they're pretty cool, those videos.
Yeah, it was really good to go and to see all that. Do you know what I mean? To see someone who is famed not for just I suppose he's got that really good balance of kind of being that kind of guitar guy that all these people kind of look up to and being an absolute gearhead as well. So yeah. Like everyone's like not only amazed about the playing and the songwriting, but also about his actual guitar rig. And yeah, I mean, like, just looking at some of the guitars, it's crazy. He gets lent a lot of stuff, so people, like, when we're talking to Mike, his tech, they were like, yeah, people, like, give us stuff to take on tour. And
well, it's part of some sort of club, isn't it? A kind of vintage Gibson.
Yeah, I think there's like
that get in touch with him through that organisation.
Well, I mean, it's the same as like Stradivarius violins. Is that Stradivarius violins aren't owned generally by players. Like the big ones are owned by big companies who hire them out because vintage instruments need to be played. They need to be used.
Yeah.
They can't sit in a case, and generally, when they do, they don't have any. In the simplest way, they don't have any like character or soul. I suppose is way you know if you pick up. I've picked up like vintage '60s guitars that are like almost new. You would think they were new, and you're kind of like, oh, it's
not quite as good as one that's been kind of got a bit of air to it over the years.
But yeah, people, you know, lend him gear and stuff like that. And I know he owns a lot of stuff himself. I mean, if you follow him on Twitter, like, he's just like, yeah, just pick this up. And it's just like some crazy vintage Les Paul or some old Gibson or Fender.
He always
like
posts pictures of Firebirds, like the rarest Firebirds you could find.
Like Firebird
weird
ones.
Non-reverse
when
Firebird.
When we saw him, he played a Firebird one, didn't he?
Yeah.
Horse guitar.
So, but I mean, I was doing a bit of digging today and kind of looking at what he has been using. And obviously in the early part of his career, he was kind of using Strats and Tellys a bit. But it's Les Pauls, isn't it? I mean, that's seems to be the
what he's sort of most famed for.
Yeah. What, do you know what he's playing off? Is it like 58s, 59s?
Well, he has actually got a signature.
Okay.
Which I don't think is now commercially available, but he actually uses that quite a lot, which is his signature gold top.
Okay.
but, I mean, obviously, you see him on stage quite a lot with... I think actually some of the main guitars he uses now, he actually uses an Ernie Ball, I think, quite a lot.
He's got those Music Man guitars, isn't he?
He uses a couple of different Music Mans, including a baritone and a double neck, but like he's used a couple of Music Mans, which you see him playing quite a few videos. Because they are like really beefy-sounding guitars.
Definitely.
Really well-built and crazy money
Still got that Access Sport second-hand?
Oh, man, yeah. We've got an Access Super Sport second-hand, basically brand-new, two P90s. I mean, that's just... Well, that's like Eddie Van Halen almost, isn't it? I mean, that's like that.
We've got a Luke as well at the moment, haven't we?
That's gone.
Has it gone?
Yeah, it's gone.
No, I've
loved those guitars ever since I started working in guitar shops.
And Luke Taft, one of our purchasers, has recently picked himself up.
He got one, did he?
Yeah, well, I think he's thinking about it.
Yeah, yeah. It's in the office at the moment.
And Joss, another guy who works here, just bought
the same one, isn't he?
An Albert Lee Rosewood neck.
They seem to be the in guitar at the moment. It's really weird because it's such a kind of esoteric shape, isn't it? The Albert Lee signature. But I see bands using them all the time, particularly like young metal bands, young punk bands. They're playing like Albert Lee guitars because they're, you know, there's nothing that looks like that.
St. Vincent's new guitar is an Albert Lee.
Well, I mean,
well,
in the bass department, I can't believe we've still got the Big H, the Big Al.
I know.
That guitar is so
good. It's
absolutely
brilliant. It's got a ridiculous amount of switching options on it as well.
I think that kind of puts people off. But anyway, I guess we're a bit off track here. So he's been playing a Music Man. What, if you were going to, if you were after that Bonamassa sound, which I guess is the kind of end goal of this podcast, particularly if you were looking for a similar thing to the Les Pauls that he's been using, what is out there, what's available?
Well, I suppose really it depends on your budget, your wallet, should we say. But we'll go for, let's pick three options. So most expensive, I would buy 58 or 59 reissue. I mean, the Les Paul Collector's Choice number 3 that came out with the Bigsby, that was based on one that Joe Bonamassa owns. Collector's Choice number 1, which is no longer available, but a similar 59, which is like the Melvin Franks, the Gary Moore one. Like something like that, you know, traditional 59 Les Paul with those kind of custom buckers, just a real classic look, feel, you know, and quite low output pickups. So working with a big amp combination like he uses is going to give you that kind of all round, that really like bottom endy sort of like fat tone. I tend to find sometimes if you plug a Strat in, you just find it's a bit too piercing,
isn't it? A bit too brittle.
Yeah, where that Les Paul's got all that extra oomph to it.
He did mention, I think, even when he was when you were interviewing him about how he's come to prefer 60s necks.
Yeah,
on Les Pauls though as well.
Yeah, that's true. He did have a 60 there, didn't he? He had like one of the ones they call the what's the nickname they give for the soupy ones? They call it like Campbell Burst because it's that real like tomato soup.
Oh
like,
yeah,
kind
yeah.
Of that real
yeah.
Like vibrant red.
Yep.
But yeah, so all you go for is, I think anything if you went for 58, 59, or 60s. They're all designed around the same sort of thing. I think the main difference is really, if to anyone who was going to pick one up who wasn't 100% sure what the main difference is the instant feel in the neck profile and how they change. And then if you wanted to go cheaper than that, I'd say maybe Les Paul traditional.
Yeah.
Like classic 57 pickups, you know, non-chambered, so it's got all that weight behind it. And then on the cheaper side of things, then probably... maybe just like a Les Paul Studio.
Yeah, definitely. I think they're such a good option. I mean, you're not going to get anything Sunburst at the moment, is that right?
They do. No, they do a Sunburst Pearl. I think they do like a vintage Sunburst Pearl.
They're nice as well. They're very different. Is it like a real super modern take on a Les Paul, isn't it? They're all like pearl metallic finishes on the studios.
Yeah, and they've all got the switchable boost as well.
Oh yeah, 15 dB boost, which actually if you're doing Bonamassery stuff, you know, if you ever need like a solo boost, might be really useful.
Yeah. So yeah, definitely those three. But I mean, realistically, if you're going to kind of nail it straight off, then it's
58, 59, 60.
It's weird though, because a lot of his licks and a lot of his guitar playing, a lot of it's taken from like a lot of the runs are very Eric Johnson in the way that he goes. And it's funny how he's kind of taken that and Eric Johnson, who's really a Strat player, and taking it all to kind of Les Paul gives it like a whole different sound.
How about amps then? If we've kind of settled on the fact that he's sort of playing Les Pauls, but we mentioned Music Man as well, what amps is he backing that up with? And I mentioned he's probably using a few different ones.
Yeah.
What's the most common combination?
I mean, if you're going to go for something that I think is available and you wanted a wide range of tones, then probably maybe a Marshall and like a Fender, like an old Fender, like doing a 68 Deluxe or something like that. I think because, as people know, if you've seen the amps that he uses, things like, you know, a lot of people out there will probably hear things like Dumble and stuff like that, the amps that go for like $150,000 if you can get them, built by one crazy mad man who, in America in the early 90s, I think was. Yeah, like the Overdrive Special, because I've got a feeling that each one of those... I don't know, maybe there was another company around the same sort of time called Train Wreck Amps.
Okay.
And I think he only built 100, and each one, instead of being serial numbered, was a different girl's name.
Okay.
And so they've all, like, each one is totally unique. And that's the thing with Dumbles, that each one that was kind of, like, changed as the amps went along.
Yeah.
And that's what gives him that kind of real high gain sound. But I still think you could probably DSL.
Yeah.
Good kind of crunchy sound. Good, fairly high gain lead sound, and then go for a Fender 68. So you've got input one, the custom inputs, that like bassman esque tweedy, a little bit darker, a little bit kind of more of a breakup, and I think those two together will work fine. I mean, usually you see them with like three or four, but I mean, you're not going to go. No one's going to go down.
No one's going to do that.
Just to nail the sound, I don't think you need. I think running two amps together. Something a little bit crunchy, a little bit darker sounding, and then something like a Marshall for kind of more of the mid-range punch would be.
I still think that's a really good way to think about using two amps. Like, plugging the gaps. So Fender is obviously, you know, it's covering the kind of bass end and it's covering the top end, and then that Marshall is really like filling in the middle.
Well, yeah, as I mean, as I was saying earlier about what I'm doing, so what I'll do is I'll set one amp up and I'll go, yeah, that's an amazing sound, that's cool. And then I'll dial in the other amp, so I'll have them running both at the same time, but I'll turn the volume all the way off on one. Then I'll turn the volume up on the other, and then you suddenly feel this warmth and extra depth that your other amp is giving you.
It's really like just a blend, isn't it, of the two, and working out where they sit.
And I think the thing is, you've got two amps and you don't really notice any difference. You can't feel the other one coming in, and you've got two amps that realistically probably sound too similar.
Yeah, I mean, running, for example, two Fenders is really only just going to give you an increase in volume. It's not filling in.
Yeah, or you want like a big, spacious sound.
Yeah.
But if you want a tone that is more well-rounded, then I would say, you know, run two amps that are relatively different.
Definitely. If we're talking about something, a kind of setup, really, if someone's looking at perhaps two combos, which I think would be a slightly more workable way round, what should they be looking at, one Fender and one Marshall? Well, Fender, you've already said the 68 Deluxe.
Yeah, 68 Deluxe. But if you don't want to spend as much money on that, you could go for a 68 Princeton, like the silver face Princeton. Even a black face Princeton, they sound pretty good.
Would something like a Hot Rod Deluxe do it?
Yeah, if you want to go for something brighter sounding, the reason that I go for the Deluxes is because they're lower powered.
Yeah.
And I think if you're going to be turning the amps up, so you want something. I think the thing is, you just won't turn the Fender up enough. I think it will stay too clean, or you'll use the drive tone and it'll be too distorted.
Yeah.
Sticking with the Marshall, I'd say like a DSL-40.
Okay.
You know, and just use the drive channel on that, or use the crunch channel and just wind back the gain so you've just got a fatter sound, and just have them both on together, and then use an overdrive pedal to kind of push it over the edge, I would say.
That's an excellent segue into looking at Joe Bonamassa's pedals. You were both lucky enough to see the pedal board, weren't you?
Yeah.
Was there much stuff on there, or was it
less than I thunk?
Well,
less than I thunk.
I kind of had that today when I was looking at the list of what he's actually got on his board, and it is much less than I imagined.
Yeah. You've actually put something on our notes for this, which I thought was very apt, in saying that he makes a point of using pedals that you can find very easily on the market. And I think certainly when we saw his pedal board, I think in comparison to the racks and racks of guitars that you and me will never, ever be able to afford, and then all the vintage amps that even if we ever manage to save up the money for them, won't even be around by the time we manage to, because they're so awesome and old and vintage. The pedal board was...
I think it's funny, really, because, you know, I made a point a while ago of kind of going, oh, yeah, you know, because I do, everyone knows that I love pedals, and I was like, yeah, vintage pedals. Yeah, just loads of old... But I've had loads of old pedals, and old pedals sound great until you try and use them all the time, and then they break.
Yeah.
Because they are really old. And I think that's the thing, is that you're probably more likely to, you know, amps are designed to be turned on and turned up loud night after night and last a very long time. And as his tech said, they very rarely change the valves. They don't mess around with what stock they leave what's in there. And guitars, you know, you can refret them, you can set them up. But pedals, like, you might as well just use what's on the floor. I mean, he uses a DD3 as his main delay pedal.
Yeah.
And as, you know, we spoke to Jay from Roland, they haven't really changed the DD3 since they released it.
Yeah.
It's effectively the same unit. I think the only thing is the processor chip has got slightly smaller.
Well, let's do a quick rundown of the board in kind of order. So the drives mainly are kind of take up most of his board, I guess. And the obvious one to look at is the Ibanez TS-808, the kind of classic Tube Screamer issue.
Yeah.
We've talked about them loads, but for people who don't know, what is a TS-808 going to give you?
It's going to give you, I suppose, one of the early pedals to give you kind of like amp-like distortion or amp-like drive.
It gives you more character drive than it does just sort of a straight-up layer of distortion.
I think it's quite light. There's not tons of gain in there.
It enhances everything rather than...
Yeah, it's almost... You're going to use something like that in conjunction with an amp that might already be slightly crunchy, or you're just going to maybe leave it on all the time if you want a slightly bigger tone and roll back on the volume on your guitar. A lighter side of kind of overdrives, nothing too crazy, like, you know, we talk about TS9s a lot that are kind of mid-heavy and a lot more saturated. These are much brighter, a little bit more top-end and less gain in their overall kind of structure.
What about the... I was reading that Bonamassa is fairly friendly with George Tripps, who is the... What is he? Head designer of Way Huge?
Yes, so he was the original guy that built Way Huge pedals, then left it all for a while, and then Dunlop were like, hey man, come back and build some...
Do Way Huge again. Get Way Huge.
Yeah, because he also helped design the Bonamassa Fuzz Face.
Okay.
Which I won't talk about because we can't get them.
Okay.
Because... of the lead content in the units themselves make them unavailable to the UK.
Wow. Not, is that the same for the rest of Europe?
They're not ROHS compliant.
Wow. So they're not available in Europe.
And I don't actually know how it would work if you bought one from America.
Probably wouldn't get through customs.
No, you'd be able to. I'm sure unless private ownership of that sort of thing would be fine. I'm sure it's more commercial license restriction.
But you could use a normal fuzz face.
Yeah.
Like a similar
job. Yeah. But anyway, so back on to Way Huge. Joe's got a pork loin on his board. Yeah. I'm not too familiar with the pork loin. What's it all about?
It's actually very, very similar to something like the 808, but there's more gain in there. It's like a high gain tube screamer. So that's what he uses for kind of more of that overdrive pedal distortion sound, because there is a big distinction between amp overdrive and
overdrive pedal.
I think for a long time overdrive pedals were like, yeah, emulate the sound of your amp overdriving, but actually as amps changed and drive channels became more apparent or more common rather, they do sound fairly different. So this gives you all now gain pedal distortion, your guitar's going to cut through a lot more, but it's kind of mass amounts of gain without that kind of fizziness that you might get from just turning the gain all the way up on a preamp channel on a Marshall, for example. You can wind it back and use that to give you a lot more.
So the last one he's got on his board is a bit of a J Cross favourite. Regular listeners, even to the podcast, will know that Jay raves about this pedal. The Karl Martin Hot Drive and Boost.
Yeah.
Clues in the name, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a hot drive
and
a boost. Not the chocolate bar.
If only.
Imagine that, every time you stepped on the drive, a little boost.
Little
bar
chocolate bar comes out and into
out of
your mouth.
Stand.
And I want that pedal.
Yeah, so that would be quite good.
I told you this was going to get surreal. Yeah. Like, this is way too late for us to be recording the podcast.
But I think similar, I mean, I can't, because at the time I don't think that was on the pedal board. I remember him using a Klon Centaur, which you'll see quite a lot.
Oh yeah.
And obviously, as everyone should know by now, the best alternative, save yourself £1,500 and go and buy Electroharmonic Soul Food.
Yeah.
I can't believe this. I literally can't believe there's anyone who listens to this podcast that hasn't bought Electroharmonic Soul Food, because we might as well be sponsored by them. We talk about it so much, and it's such a good pedal.
Yeah.
And like you say, it is the best alternative to a Klon, and the Klons are £1,500-£1,600.
Yeah, and I mean...
How much is a Soul Food? £39?
£44.99, I think.
Mental. Absolutely mental.
Can't give exact figures, but I think we've sold over 150 since they were released.
That's crazy.
Ridiculous.
Because they I mean...
We couldn't even get one when they first...
The thing is,
when
like,
they released the first batch, we'd already sold them.
Drive pedals for me have always been the hardest. I've owned more of them than any other pedal, but they're the ones that I move on the quickest, because they're the ones that you kind of go, yeah, it sounds good, and then you kind of plug it in and you go, oh, maybe not. And £45, it's just worth having there as something that you might need or use or have on your board at any point, really.
And again, like you were saying with the TS-808, it's a pedal that you could use in a few different ways. You could leave it on to brighten things up, because it's got almost like a treble booster vibe to it. But it can get really nasty as well, can't it, when you wind the gain up?
Yeah, so yeah, 100%.
For £45, unbelievable. And so Bonamassa also uses some modulation stuff. Boss CH1, you know, it is what it is. It was one of the first chorus pedals.
It's definitely one of the it's what followed on from like the CE1.
Yeah.
So they're kind of the big Boss unit. And yeah, I mean, still. I mean, that's the thing about Boss's legacy, and we do go on it a lot. And I saw a thing at a forum the other day. It was like a sales forum. Someone's like, "Oh, I'm after some new pedals. Decent pedals only. No Boss." And it's like,
"What?
Hold on, hold on there.
Boss is best."
Yeah, I mean,
there's someone just assuming just because they're the most prolific.
Exactly, and that's the thing that we've always had before when we met with the guys from Boss, and we were saying, you know, this is a big thing that you know. I don't think they necessarily maybe always realise is that people think, oh, just because you see them everywhere, then they're not good. But when you see people like that using it and still going, well, look, I've still got, like I said to us before, I've still used the DD3 as well as my timeline, and I actually probably use the DD3 more just because it's a great sounding delay straight out of the box.
I always think that they're a victim of their own success, like in the same way that a Strat is. You know, people come in and go, I need to get a new guitar, not a Strat. Everyone's got a Strat. And you think, yeah, it's kind of the same with Boss, really. Yeah. People come in and go, and like you say on that forum, like, no, not Boss. But actually, you know, Boss have got this huge legacy. They've got pedals that are still been going since they started.
The CH1 has been going for like 25 years.
Yeah.
The reason there's no CH2, CH3, whatever, is because the CH1 was right.
Yeah, it's an absolutely brilliant, you know, chorus pedal.
And I think that's why they've gone to the OD1X and the DS1X, is that they are right. They don't,
yeah.
You know, they. I think that's the thing, is why you don't see them going into like the 9s and the 10s, is because they don't need to.
Yeah. What about an RE20?
Yeah, but that, you know, no, it's because no one can buy a Space Echo, and at 201s they've taken the number off, so if anything
it's better.
Better
because it's before.
Yeah.
Well, that, I mean, that segues nicely into the fact that for his ambient pedals, like you've mentioned, DD3 and Boss RV5, which I think is a bit of an underrated pedal. It's a kind of dark horse in the reverb race. You know, we've often kind of espoused the values of things like the TC Electronic Hall of Fame, and obviously you love the Strymon stuff.
Yeah.
What's your vibe on the RV5?
I really like it, but the key to any reverb, and this is the thing, is that people turn the effects level up way too much.
Yeah.
And actually, after messing around with the Big Sky phrases, I was like, actually, mix all the way, almost all the way down, because what you really want is, when you're playing, you want it to be there but not to be heard almost. But when you stop playing, yeah, you want that effect to be there, you want that effect to be felt.
So you can build a big reverb but keep the mix down.
Yeah. And then when you stop playing, you can hear, and that's the, I think that's always the key to good delay sound, is actually less repeats.
Yeah.
Because you don't want it to intrude on what you're playing until you've finished, and then it kind of comes in at the end. So actually a totally underrated pedal, especially when you're running multiple amps and you want, well, and you want a big stereo sound. Just being able to split A and B, all that's doing is splitting a mono signal into two mono inputs.
You know, so RV5 stereo out?
Yeah. I can't, because he was using, I think, 4 amps at the time. I think there was, and he's got a three-way selector. I've got a feeling that one of the outputs was running into an RV5 that was going into both amps at the same time. And then you could switch between the other two.
Your setups are almost very similar.
Yeah, mine's better.
Taking some tips from JB.
No, he's taking tips from me.
Yeah, well, that's what I'd like to think. Oh, I think on that note, we should just do some staff picks and share some of your tips. Matt Knight, what have you been playing this week?
I've been playing. I think we've all had a little bit of a play today on this guitar, because it is awesome.
Yeah, we've been doing a bit of filming after work, which is why we're recording late. And
one of the guitars
we were actually playing the Soul Food as well, weren't we?
We were. That's, you know, influence.
I mean, that just put that on everything.
Yeah, just why not have it plugged in?
Drum tracks.
Was the Soul Food the drive you were using for the demos you did today as well?
No, I actually used the OnePlug Plexi drive.
Oh, did you?
But still, both good. Both good.
Except the Soul Food is a third of the price.
Yeah. Yep. So, what have you been playing?
American Deluxe Strat Plus. Finally here. The guitar with the cards.
Now, we've mentioned this a bit before. Wallet.
Well, we mentioned it after the NAMM podcast, NAMM, didn't we?
Yeah, I first saw it. They launched it at NAMM.
Vietnam.
They launched it at NAMM, and it was a tad confusing because I didn't get to see it in action. The only time I saw it was when I was talking to one of the guys from Fender, and he kind of flipped open the hatch on the back of the guitar and went, look, personality cards. Yeah, and he read off a load of spiel, and actually I didn't quite get my head round what they were doing. I think Fender had quite a problem actually getting it across at the show what these things were.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, is it digital or is it... Do you have to do anything else to the guitar? Are you literally just swapping these things in and out? I don't know. But actually, sitting down with it today made a whole lot more sense.
When when you guys, when we first spoke about it, actually, on the podcast before, and you were talking about... referring them to what they are known as personality cards, I had this kind of sort of Top Trumps idea of, like, cards, maybe with, like, holes in them, you know, that maybe with a picture of Jimi Hendrix's face on them, and you put it in the back and it scans the irises of Jimi Hendrix's face in the picture and inputs sort of his sound.
I wasn't sure if it was going to be something like physically digital in a sense. And I suppose it is in a way, but digital in the sense that you plugged it into... Like the Fishman Triple Play, like it's something, some sort of wireless thing that interacts with.
Like you say, some sort of, I don't know, some interface.
Yeah.
But it's kind of not...
Like a Variax, but no actual guitar modelling. I don't know, because, like you say, they didn't really say anything about it. And it wasn't until that I kind of got it down today and saw it come into the warehouse. I was like, oh, boy, you should definitely get this. And actually had a look and read through the different personality cards. I was like, that's actually... like sort of makes sense. It's basically on the face of it, it's
almost just understandable.
Yeah
I mean, actually when we actually demoed all the personality cards, I was like, this is actually a really, really good idea. Like, definitely not a thing that you're going to do mid gig.
No,
I wouldn't have thought.
Well, I mean, they give you the kind of that gig worthy wallet that you put the cards into that. I think they think that you'll do it mid gig, but in reality probably not.
So no way. Yeah, basically on the face of it, standard deluxe Strat, 9.5 to 14 inch radius, so compound board, 22 frets, M3 noiseless pickups, this one's maple neck, 2-point trem, micro tilt on the neck, so, you know, just a great workhorse guitar. But this personality thing that plugs into the back, so the one that comes with it, and I think there are going to be more, was the, what was it, the cutter and the
growler.
So you get the standard, you do not get the growler. You get the standard, which is inserted as standard, the cutter and the blender.
Yeah. And actually, the blender was my favourite one, because how most people want, like, that David Gilmour thing of having the neck and the bridge on, effectively putting this card in meant that in your bridge position, you had a master tone control, and then the second tone control then blended in the neck pickup in the bridge position, the neck pickup in the middle and bridge position, and then in the reverse, the neck position or the neck and middle, it blended in the bridge, which I thought was a really good idea.
That's a really useful sort of
the fact that you could
Gilmour
just
thing.
Go between those two with just the change of cards, and each card's got these little dip switches on as well, which control the overall tone output.
It actually sounded great as well when you were doing it, that one especially.
My thoughts on it would be, it's much easier to change the cards than I imagined. And also, I think it breathes life into a pickup that I don't normally like. I don't normally like those N3s.
100%,
Those N3s normally, to me, sound a bit like sterile, but they didn't sound like that on that guitar at all.
I mean, they're good pickups, but they're like the...
Lace sensors?
Yeah, they're like the lace sensors before it. They're just kind of... they're good pickups, but they're kind of... I heard someone describe them once as like plastic pickups. So they sound Stratty, but they sound Stratty with all the kind of vintage Strat, without the vintage Strat character.
Yeah.
You know, very kind of to the point. But these, like, that didn't sound like a normal deluxe Strat.
No, not at all.
And actually, the cutter was great for just almost basically active tone controls.
Yeah.
Well, that's what it was virtually, wasn't it?
Well, it wasn't active because there's no battery involved.
No, but
there... what it gives you
is... how it works. I have no idea how
it
works.
I'm not sure, but it's a separate bass and treble control, isn't it?
Exactly. So rather than an overall tone, it's giving you, split like bass and treble that you can... that basically take away from the top.
Yeah. And all the electronics in it are completely solderless. So I think there's... Fender have obviously got plans to release extra components that you can swap in and out, and more personality cards as well.
Yeah. I think for me, the kind of takeaway from it is that it's almost like a perfect recording guitar. Because if you imagine, like, the range of tones, even... so, you get your normal set of standard Strat tones, pop in one of those other cards, you get pretty much a whole nother five sounds. Plus you get the dip switches on the card that then, you know, take off treble or take off bass,
yeah,
or, you know, mid scoop and stuff like that, and give you the different switching options. I just think for a recording studio or someone who, you know, likes strats but just wants a bit more and will often need to record more sounds than a regular strat gives you, it's a perfect guitar.
Yeah.
And collector's item of the future.
Well, maybe.
Yeah, well, I think so. I think it'd be one of those ones that I don't think many people will try straight away, although I definitely think you should. And I think people are going to be like, oh, remember them. Strat. Well, I mean, they already had a Strat Plus. This is the Deluxe Strat Plus.
Yeah, American Strat.
Because the amount of people American that Deluxe come in Strat and Plus. Say, oh, I used to have one, actually. Strat Plus, the early 90s Strat Plus is great guitars. And I think this is going to be, it's going to be something similar.
Joe, what have you been playing this week?
This week, just coming back to kind of, I suppose, what I was saying at the start about my big old amp dilemma.
Okay.
My alternative to going stereo was to just get something really big. So it was kind of, I still can't quite get away from that thing of really wanting a cabin amp head.
You just want
match.
A huge amp, don't you?
Oh yeah, I do, obviously. But I can't get away from wanting them to match. So okay. So I'm looking at, you know, one brand for both, which is probably silly.
A stack is what you want.
Exactly. So I was looking, because I'm trying to get a bigger amp, and so the cab is kind of the most important thing. My prerequisite for the head is really that it has a valve preamp in it, and that's about it. So for the cab, I was looking at people that do good big cabs.
Yeah.
That are, you know, rugged enough for me to tour quite a lot and aren't mega, mega super bucks. So I really like the Hotkey High Drive stuff. They're great. They do, like, you know, their 410 can handle like 1,000 watts, which is great. But they're quite a lot of dosh for a 410.
Yeah.
And I kind of wanted something a bit more than a 410. And the next one up is, unfortunately, an 810. There's no in between.
Which you've already said.
Yeah.
No.
Too big, especially in the High Drive series. Those things weigh a ton.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was looking at kind of other sort of big, robust, well-built amps, and that led me to a brand that I don't give enough time, certainly on this podcast, Ashdown. Their ABM series is a really kind of tried and tested range. I mean, if you go onto their website, they have like an artist's section.
It's crazy the amount of people that use Ashdown.
It's ridiculous. There must be 500 names on there, and for each one I can click on them and it shows me what they're using. I didn't recognize half the names, but I'm clicking on them and it's all like, all of it's like ABMs. Bear in mind the amount of different gear that they do.
Yeah,
it must have been 95% ABMs, and a lot of the time I was surprised that it was ABM 500 heads.
Okay.
As well, which isn't even their British built series. I was, you know, you'd expect to see the ABM 1000s.
Yeah.
Or the 900s, actually. Guy Pratt uses the ABM 900 randomly.
Really?
Yeah, the 900. You'd think, again, he could just use the 1000, but no, he uses the 900, which is the Far Eastern built sort of stereo two times 575 watt job. But yeah, and then basically they do a 610, which is great. I love the look of the ABM series. They're really sort of rock and roll and robust and tour ready. So I was like, well, yeah, those are great. And they're like sub 600 quid for the 610s. And then the ABM 500, which is, again, sub 600 quid for the head. And you get a ton of features on there that maybe I just don't... I haven't really sort of had a look at and tried out. But I was like... I was trying it out earlier today, and I was like, oh, this is great. I love the sort of the valve drive, that having that as like a push-pull is like a separate sort of thing that you can bring in and out, and kind of all the options, having the things like the octave and the compressor and the valve drive foot switchable as well, I think make the head incredibly versatile and just something that I think for me sometimes gets swept under the carpet by things like the Orange Tiny Terror as kind of like the affordable rock head since Ampeg have sort of not been there so much. But the ABM 500 and a 610 is something you can pick up for less than 1,200 quid for an absolutely full on, like you will never need to buy anything again or anything bigger or make any additions to this rig.
Sounded good earlier when you were playing it.
Yeah,
very
yeah,
good.
Exactly. Yeah, it was great, and that was just flat with the valve drive on sort of a fairway and a little bit of compression because I didn't have time to plug in a compressor to it. So yeah, wicked bits of gear. So that's my stuff pick.
Matt Knight, I've got a question for you.
Yes.
Do you own an iPad?
Technically.
Do you like recording your guitar?
Yes, although I never get around to it because it is too difficult.
Okay, well, I've got just the solution for you.
This wasn't planned, by the way.
No. This week, I've been playing around with the Focusrite iTrack dock. Now, I can't remember whether I've had this as a staff pick before. I've got a sneaking suspicion that I have, but I've actually had time to play with it this week because they've only just arrived. So the iTrack dock is basically the first real way of recording to an iPad that has appealed to me. All the other ones, you need to get like a different connection cable and
like the I/O dock and stuff like
that. Yeah, well, I mean, the I/O dock, I just think the preamps weren't quite as up to scratch.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What the iTrack dock is, it's like almost like a little mixing console. Almost looks like an old four track.
Yeah.
But you just slide your iPad in, long as you've got like a Lightning connection iPad, which all the modern ones are.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, you just slide it in there. It's got loads of controls on the front, dedicated guitar input.
So you don't. I'm assuming there is an app that you can use, but there's actually controls on the unit itself.
Yeah. So you could use GarageBand, but it also Focusrite. I've got a little app that's like a two track recorder called Tape. Which is literally just like a two-track stereo tape machine. So you could use that, or yeah, GarageBand if you want to do multi-track recording. So dedicated guitar in, plus two other ins. So either XLR on either, or there's a line in on either. So for keyboards or like, you know, synth or whatever. Plus USB in. So if you've got, for example, a controller keyboard that's USB, you can just USB in there, and that'll act as a controller.
Wow.
It's just, I can imagine having one of these just on the side and with a pair of headphones connected, and you just pop your iPad in. Like, at home at the moment, I've got my laptop plugged into Pro Tools M-Box, which is then plugged into my speakers, which the whole thing just takes a load of time to power up, and I hardly ever sit down, and where I am is like a bit cramped to play guitar. You could just have this in the living room, pair of headphones, plug your iPad in, and then plug your guitar in, and you're sort of ready to go without too
crazy
much
convenient
setup. And of course, having kind of access to the screen as well means that it's, you know, all touchscreen, and actually setting up a session in GarageBand is super easy. And they're not huge money. They're £170, £169.99.
That's not a huge amount of money
at
all.
I'm assuming it records onto the iPad, not onto the actual dock itself.
Exactly. So what you've got on the dock is, the dock's almost like a sound card, and then all the recording is done on the iPad itself. But that's no different from if you were using like an external sound card.
Yeah.
This just kind of acts as almost like a little hub where you plug the iPad into. Really good volume control on the front, and everything's laid out super neat. I just think that'd be an amazing sketch pad to have at home.
Yeah.
If I had an iPad, I would definitely get one, which is why I recommend it to you, Matt Knight, because you have an iPad. And yeah, anyone else listening who's got an iPad, you should seriously check out the iTrack dock. It just kind of works. It's the first one of these that I've been really impressed by. I think it's because it just makes it, once you plug the iPad in, it just kind of looks like an old four track, which is actually what I'm more used to recording onto.
Yeah. I remember my mate, when I still went to uni, he was like, oh, I really want to record guitar, but obviously computer recording was, you know, everyone was still computer recording, but there wasn't as much tech.
Yeah.
I think like 6 or 7 years ago, there was like, I'm definitely remember when I started working here, Pro Audio not having as much like cheap gadgetry, as it were, not in the sense of cheap manufacture, but just cheap products like that you could record. And he went around everywhere trying to find an old tape four track, and for a few years you could still go and buy tapes, but now you can't even go and buy blank cassettes. But he did all of his demos on that for years, and now he's like, oh, that, you know, I can't. And it's the same as me, I can't be bothered to plug guitar into an interface into something else.
The first bit of recording kit that I remember buying before I worked here, I actually bought from here,
Tascam four track.
No, I had, bizarrely had one of those later on. The first thing that I bought, recording-wise, four-track mini disc recorder.
Oh my god!
Oh yeah,
and that mini disc lasted like all of 2 seconds.
Well, no, in some countries in the world, still very popular. But this iTrack dock kind of reminds me of that. Just the way that the hardware's built and how easy it is to plug in and just get recording. I think even that mini disc recorder had like a dedicated guitar in that you could just plug a guitar level thing in. So, definitely, if you want an easy recording solution and something to have like away from your studio, if you've already got one, then the iTrack dock kind of does the business if you've got an iPad.
Someone called up and asked if we sold floppy disks the other day.
Wow. Can you even buy? I remember buying zip disks.
Can still buy floppy disks because not from us. But I released a single on one a little while ago. We talked about this last week.
Yeah, we did. You can obviously, there is somewhere that you can order them, you know, probably over the internet from Zimbabwe, but I don't think they are especially proliferate.
Not from us, certainly.
Proliferate?
Yeah.
Is that a word?
Let's do some questions.
Yeah.
Ollie on Twitter says, the Boss GT001 desktop effects that you rave about in the podcast, would that be a good device for bassists? Any bass guitar patches? Matt Knight.
I'm still having fun with the GT001. I'm actually kind of led on a little bit from what you were saying about the iTrack dock, because it's actually, because everything's kind of all in one, it does eliminate the fact of plugging it, having loads of different things set up, but you'd still need some sort of recording software. But because I'm not really a bass player, although I have plugged my bass 6 into it, I still use my bass 6 like a guitar, because that's what it is. I've got a feeling, because I don't think the GT100 has any bass specific patches on it.
It doesn't, because they released a GT100B.
Yeah. As well. So I think the 001, as far as I'm aware, is just patches.
It is at the moment. But me and Mark were talking about this. Does it have to be? Because I don't know how much of it's kind of on board, because it's all digital, you know.
Well, there could be stuff updated in the future.
I was going to say, it doesn't have to be, it's not voiced specifically for guitar. Something more.
You've got an XLR input in there for microphones, you've got mic preamps in there.
Yeah, exactly.
And like the Line 6 amplifier, when I said, what about plugging bass in? He said, well, use something like a JCM 900, turn the gain back and turn the cab off, because that's what, you know, if you were going to run a bass into a guitar amp, you'd probably use something like a Marshall like that.
I think it'd be one of those things where you could probably get away with it. If that was your main interface, you could do, like you're saying, like use a guitar patch. I always used to go for like Fender stuff. When I had one of the old pods, I'd just use a Fender amp with the gain off with no cab. And that would probably do it, but you're not going to find like bass specific effects there at the moment.
The great thing about, so there's two things that would make it easier for bass players than I think ever has been on that thing. Boss Tone Central.
Yep.
So the fact that you can plug it in, you can edit everything on screen. So there's no fiddling through menus. You can literally drag and drop stuff and change it. You can hit a few notes and change it. But reamping, I mean, that's the key. Record all your bass parts totally dry, no preamp, with the DI setting on the output. Send it all back over USB and just edit, just mess around with it in real time until you get the sound you want, and then just re-record it all and reamp it all.
Yeah, that side of it's very, very useful.
Yeah. I mean, live, you wouldn't use it, I don't think, unless you plug. I mean, I don't. They've not aimed this product at being
used live.
If you're going to use, you want these sounds live, then realistically, you would set them up in a GT100, I think you can do, in the sense that you can transfer all your GT001 patches to a GT100, because when you download the Tone Central editor, it says GTW1/GT100. So I think that the settings are almost universal between the two.
Yeah, sweet. That's reminded me, I still have not yet done any ME80 patches. Weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I've got a week off next week, some of which I'm going on a mystery holiday, which I don't know where that is yet.
Hey.
But some of which will be spent at home. And I promise I will try and do some ME80 user guides. I
promise you will try.
And patches. I promise I will try to do those things. So the Baron on Twitter says, would be interested to know your thoughts on EQ pedals. No one seems to talk about or review them. I've got a Boss G7 and find it great at dialing in a specific tone, but never read or hear anyone else talking about them. Wondered about your thoughts on the subject. Maybe they're just not sexy enough of a pedal.
They're not a very sexy pedal. That is absolutely killer EQ pedal.
I love how you said that.
Yawning.
Yeah,
it was perfect. It's not a very sexy pedal, but they are wicked and essential, especially the G7. I think that's an absolutely killer pedal.
Yep.
I've got a G7B on my board for bass. And I think they're... For guitars, I think EQ pedals make great boosts, and kind of, you know, just for giving a different sort of tone there. For bass, I use mine with kind of everything, like shut down except for sort of all the low end faders, so it just gives me like a really sub sound, so I can.
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of people just use them for crane boost, keep everything flat and just
for a long time.
And they're wicked for that. Yeah. The G7.
I think if you actually just want a volume boost, they're still probably the best option, because they've got that like 15 dB boost.
And they are purely just volume. There's no tonal change in there.
No,
really.
Exactly. Leave the EQ flat and then boost that.
Mm. Well, actually, talking of EQ, it's actually a good question, because it made me remember that we've just taken on, as I think I briefly mentioned last week, Source Audio, who do a programmable EQ pedal. So you can set like 10 different preset EQs, and it's on about the same size as like a Boss G7. But for me, it is MIDI programmable. So I could set different MIDI presets per patch on my thing. So yeah, you could literally have a different EQ for every patch on my pedal board, which would be awesome. And also, Empress do like something, do the power EQ, which is like the parametric EQ.
Yeah,
that which is you... really good for that kind of Queens of the Stone Age sort of like that real like, honky, like loads of mid range without being ridiculously harsh.
Because you can find that mid sweet spot and really like boost it up.
Yeah, and that is a forgotten effect, really, like parametric EQ.
Yeah,
which you can find on the brilliant, even lower priced Line 6 M5, because I sold one on Saturday and they are £85, which is insane.
There we go. I think that's covered it. Hopefully, the Baron, that helps you out.
But a really annoying pedal board size.
What? Yeah.
The M5.
M5.
Oh, yeah. It's just really annoying. Really heavy as well, so it doesn't sit on the Velcro that
Maybe
well.
Maybe they'll do one called the M1, and it'll be like just the size of like a normal, but without the MIDI and all the tap tempo. Maybe with the
preset. I can't believe you've just bad-mouthed the M5.
I love the M5. I'm rearranging my pedal board at the moment, and it's the bane of my life.
I thought about buying another one.
Oh, God, they're just
Why don't you buy it off Joe? He sounds like he doesn't want it anymore.
Yeah, what I use it for is an octaver, for God's sake.
Pop on an octave pedal.
Yeah, I know. I should just buy an octave pedal.
Gents, with that, I think we should wrap it up, because it is super late and this is getting all a touch surreal. If you've got any questions, please do fire them over to podcast@gak.co.uk, or you can get in touch on Facebook, facebook.com/GAK Music, or on Twitter @GAK_co_UK, or please do follow me on the Twitter.
Follow Mark.
Follow me, and do bug me to make Boss ME80 patches, because if
otherwise
you don't,
he won't.
I will definitely forget again. @Mark_random. Matt Knight, how can people get in touch with yous?
With me's, you can email me's at matt.knight@gak.co.uk, which is the best way to get hold of me if you want to buy anything or talk about anything that requires longer than the standard tweeting answer. 140 characters. And if you ask me about pedals, I definitely can't respond within 140 characters. No. Or you can tweet me if you want short responses. Or, as some people have been tweeting in, or one person just tweeted in a picture of the underside of his pedal board, which is amazing, because people also believe in showing the
underside.
I've been
thinking about moving my compressor to the underside of my pedal board.
Yeah,
because it's always on.
It's like a little hidden basement of joy.
Oh, yes.
But yeah, you can tweet me @Matt_Knight, that's Knight with SIE on the end. And yeah, you can show me more pictures of your pedal boards.
Joe Branton, how can people get in touch with you?
Well, you can email me on joe.branton@gak.co.uk, or you can tweet me @Yosef_900 and help me out with my bass amp dilemma by making even more suggestions to confuse me further.
Next week, as I mentioned, I'm off on holiday. Jay's still off. So Matt and Joe are going to try.
Oh,
try and do a podcast.
It's going to be, I don't even, we're not even going to edit it. It's going to be straight
it's
out.
It's going to be amazing.
Raw, X-rated.
How are we going to do the start?
I mean, Joe, there's going to be so much foul language in that. I don't know.
It's going to be bad.
Mark, we're going to make it so difficult for Mark to edit when we're
gonna have
home.
You're going to have to put beeps in.
I can't do that.
Why not?
Because it's too much work.
We're going to edit it. Let's edit it together as well.
No, I'll do the editing.
We should get a soundboard. We're getting a soundboard. We're going to have a soundboard.
We're going to prank call people.
Yeah.
Oh, we're going to Skype with people. You know, if you really want to do the Skype. I know Mark keep mentioning it. If you really want to do live Skype, then
yeah,
next week
we should probably do it without clothes as well.
Yep,
we're definitely doing that. We're going to change the start because Mark always does the start of the podcast the same.
It's going to be weird though for you to not be on a podcast.
I know, it's the first one I missed. Episode
63. But
we might start. Maybe we'll start with the end and do it backwards. We like it's literally limitless what we can do without Mark here.
I'm terrified. I get back on at the weekend. And I will edit this on Monday.
I might do the first 10 minutes speaking only Dutch, and you'll have to interpret what I'm saying.
I actually fear the way that how it's going to work out for
me. I do. So if that sounded interesting or terrifying to you, please join us next week, and we'll see where we get to.
I can't speak Dutch. It would just be... I'd just be making it up.
Oh, God. Right, bye-bye.
Felicissimo, bente belle shoes, de dale hughe safanda, buchaches! Cock.
We should do stuff like, we should like have 30 seconds to think of like the craziest effort to achieve something, and then both have to like go one after each other, and then we'll ask our listeners to rate.